From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, actor John C. Reilly. He plays a stock car driver comically devoted to his buddy Will Ferrell in the NASCAR film Talladega Nights, which will soon be out on DVD. It's a role he helped develop. We'll talk with him about starring in a comedy for a change, about his dramatic roles in films like Boogie Nights and Gangs of New York, and about appearing as Stanley Kowalski in the Broadway revival of A Streetcar Named Desire. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new animated feature Happy Feet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest, actor John C. Reilly, has appeared in 40 films, earning a reputation for authenticity that Daniel Day-Lewis recognized when accepting a Screen Actors Guild Award by saying Reilly has a habit of making those around him look like they're acting. Reilly recently co-starred in Talladega Nights, which will soon be out on DVD. His other films include Boogie Nights, Magnolia, The Perfect Storm, and The Good Girl. In 2003, he appeared in three films nominated for Best Picture: The Hours, Gangs of New York, and the musical Chicago, in which he sang and earned a Best Supporting Actor nomination. He played Lefty the Singing Cowboy in Robert Altman's A Prairie Home Companion, and he's appeared on stage. Last year, he played Stanley in the Broadway revival of A Streetcar Named Desire. In Talladega Nights, John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell play best friends who are both NASCAR drivers. Reilly's character, Cal Naughton Jr., usually helps Ferrell's character, Ricky Bobby, win races. In this scene, later in the film, Ricky Bobby has slipped as a driver and is losing his luck and his lady to Cal.
We're getting married, Ricky. And we're getting matching leprechaun tattoos.
Isn't that cute? With a little pot of gold.
Is this some kind of joke? You guys put me on?
And we just came up with a new nickname.
Oh, that is. It's so good.
I got a new
it's
nickname. So the Magic Man. Now you see me?
Now you don't.
That is the stupidest nickname I've ever heard.
Is it, Ricky? Because I think you wish you thought of it.
All right, you got me. That's an awesome nickname.
Watch the mail for that invitation to the wedding, because I want you there.
What?
Baby, he's not going to come to the wedding.
Cal, do you realize the implications of your actions right now?
What's the implication mean?
Well, John C. Reilly, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You're in the new film Talladega Nights. Some people describe you as the actor who is in every other movie that you go to. But so many of your well-known roles have been dramatic roles. And here, this is a very funny comedy with Will Ferrell. I wonder if you could pair the experience. I mean, is this like hanging around with guys and goofing off and getting paid for it?
Yeah. That at first appearance, that's what it is. Yeah, I guess it was a little bit of a different experience for me, but the truth is a lot of what I do as an actor is the same from a drama to a comedy. You know, you're just committing to the given circumstances that a character finds themselves in, and in a comedy, those circumstances are often ridiculous. Yeah, but, that said, it was a lot of fun hanging around with Will and Adam. They're incredibly funny guys, and I've known Will for a while, so we're pretty good friends. And it's always really fun to work with your friends if you can.
Yeah. Now, I heard that your role in Talladega Nights was initially smaller and then was expanded. Is that right?
Basically, what they said was, are you interested in playing this part? And I said, well, yeah, of course I'm interested in working with you guys. I feel like I've played the best friend a lot before, so I wondered if you would, could hear some of my ideas about this. And they said, absolutely, And that was one of the great pluses doing this movie. These guys, they asked me, what my ideas were for the character. And I thought, well, if I play a best friend again, he has to be the ultimate best friend. He has to be someone who's almost ridiculously devoted to his friend. And that was sort of the beginning of, how we started to think about the character.
I know that you come from a working class background in Chicago, and a lot of the humor here spoofs working people of the South, people who have, two names like Ricky Bobby and are from the Bible Belt. And I wonder if there was any discussion, and I'll say that I asked this question as a guy who grew up in South Texas and went to stock car races as a kid myself. Was there any concern on the set that some of this stuff might not sit well with, fans of NASCAR?
Well, yeah, sure there was concern. It's a big budget movie, and there were representatives from the NASCAR organization on the set every day, so people were definitely, trying to oversee it. But the fact is, if you sign on to a Will Ferrell, Adam McKay comedy, you're saying, go for it, And if you give these guys the leeway to do what they need to do, you have to be ready for some really borderline scandalous stuff and craziness. I mean, that's the job of comedy, is to
right. It's so over the top.
Make fun of the world,
right.
And this world is the NASCAR world, so we make fun of it. But you know, Will is a really good-hearted, very ethical, decent guy, and Adam is also. And then what's one of the joys of working with them? And so their viewpoint about comedy is not like a mocking kind of viewpoint. You know, I never play a character like I'm looking down on the character. That I think that's death for an actor when you start to feel like you're superior to your character. Mm-hmm. So when I embrace, you know, this crazy redneck guy named Cal Naughton Jr., I do it with a lot of affection and love, and I put myself in his place and I take his worldview, you know. So I think you can feel that in the movie.
You know, this film, in addition to being very funny, and it really is, it really captures this thundering excitement of being at a NASCAR event. And I know that you actually did a lot of taping at actual races. Mm-hmm. And if I believe you guys had to get acquainted with it by actually getting in a race car. Is that right?
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
Well, we didn't have to, but we did. You know, the truth is the insurance companies that underwrite movies get really nervous when actors even, like, you know, ride a bike. You know, they want you to sign this paperwork that says, like, I won't jet ski, I won't twirl a pool cue dangerously, I won't, you know, like, all these restrictions.
Right.
And so they weren't too hot on the idea of us driving at all, but we wanted to for research and just to even for a moment have that feeling of what it's like to go that fast and be in a race car. So we went to this driving school in Charlotte, which is that they have at the Speedway there, and we all went out in these race cars and got them up to speed. And I couldn't believe they let me do it, actually, because it was only about a 20-minute orientation, and the next thing I was going 150 miles an hour by myself in a car. It was preposterous. Like, how did they let me do this? But I had a great time doing it. You know, they first take you out as a passenger. And when I went around as a passenger, I get car sick in cars when I'm not driving, period. No matter who's driving, I get car sick. So I don't know what I was thinking, but I thought it would be fine. I get in with this professional NASCAR driver, and, you know, he took us up to like 180 miles an hour. And I'm in the passenger seat, which is on the, you know, as you're going around the turns, you're on the outside of the car. So it felt like my organs were shifting in my body, and, like, my brain was being sucked out of my ear as we're going around, and I got so sick immediately. I was white as a sheet when I got out of that car. And all these, you know, gracious people that were hosting us at this driving school were like, so, what'd you think? Giving me the big thumbs up, like, wasn't that awesome? Wasn't it exciting? And I was like, I just shut down. Like, I wanted to say the right thing to them, but I could not physically fake like I was feeling really great. So I was just like, yes, it was great. I really enjoyed that. Wow, what an experience. I'm going to go over here now and take off my helmet. Like, and then 5 minutes after that, they're like, who's going to be first to drive the car? John, Riley, let's go, hop in. And, like, next thing I know, I was starting up the car myself in the car alone and, like, going 150 miles an hour. But it was a lot more fun when I was driving.
I know that you grew up in Chicago, and mm-hmm. I've read that you weren't the most well-behaved youth. I mean, you said you had a kind of scrapes with juvenile delinquency, but got into acting, I guess, in high school, right? And then really seriously at DePaul University.
I was in
University.
Grammar school, actually. Yeah, right. I was about 8 or 9 when I first started. Yeah, my mom really gets mad when I talk about the rough South Side of Chicago or that I got into any trouble. I think she has kind of a retroactive memory or something about what I did as a kid. She's like, I don't remember that. I'm like, yeah, Mom, I got arrested for shooting a BB gun from the railroad tracks at people's windows. No, you didn't. I was like, Mom, you picked me up from the police station. Don't you remember? No, I can't believe you did that. I'm like, well, maybe you blocked it out of your memory, but the truth, it was all very harmless stuff. It wasn't right. Like, you know, it's not to make light of juvenile delinquency. You know, there's a lot of kids that have real problems. My stuff was just being bored and, you know, breaking bottles and getting caught for curfew and stuff like that. But, yeah, but acting, I mean, as I got older, I could see that some of the older guys in my neighborhood were heading down a more serious road of, you know, crime and addiction or whatever. You know, there was all kinds of stuff going on in that neighborhood. So, yeah, I was really lucky that my best friend at the time was going to the local park near my house for these drama classes, or drama, as we used to call it. He's like, you should come with me to drama. It's great. You know, we play these theater games, and it's, you know. And so I went there, and I realized, wow, these are my people. This is it. Because I had always kind of moved around from the burnouts to the jocks to the, you know, academic kind of people, and I finally found my people, the play people.
My guest is actor John C. Reilly. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor John C. Reilly. The film Talladega Nights, in which he and Will Ferrell play NASCAR drivers, comes out soon on DVD. When we left off, we were talking about his early days as an actor. I guess the big break was when you got cast in Brian De Palma's movie Casualties of War. And I know you've talked about how that was initially going to be a very small part. You were going to get injured and then disappear from the film. But then he expanded your role. But what I read was recently was that part of that came from rehearsals where they didn't have enough actors to fill in some of the parts, and he would ask you to play parts of people that weren't on the set yet. Is that right?
Yeah, he actually didn't expand my role. He gave me another role. He cast me into a cameo part that was different, and then it actually ended up giving me one of the leads of the movie, because as we got over there, the casting, he decided he was unhappy with certain actors, and it got shifted around a little bit. But yeah, that's how I kind of... That's how they found out that I had some ability. Was during the rehearsals, we'd be there and there'd be these big group scenes, you know, where we're supposed to be, the soldiers are walking through a Vietnamese village or something, and we didn't have all the actors there, of course, for the whole scene. So there'd be like an 80-year-old Vietnamese man walks up and talks to the troops, and they're like, okay, we don't have the Vietnamese guy, so we need someone to read this. John, read this part, you know. And I, of course, coming from a theater background, never having been in a movie before, never having left the United States before, or been in an airplane or anything, I just, like, completely throw myself into it like it's, you know, Tennessee Williams or something, reading the nonsensical lines of this Vietnamese guy. So I'd be just, you know, I would just try to transform myself into an 80-year-old Vietnamese guy for the purposes of the rehearsal. And I think that was much more than anyone was expecting. And so Brian took note, like, wow, look at that guy. And then there'd be a couple other examples like that. You know, now be the sentry, and now, you know, the pilot here, or whatever, these different things. And then when the opportunity opened up for some of these other roles, you know, the well was primed, let's say.
And what's interesting is it's sort of like an audition where you didn't know you were auditioning, right? It wasn't like you were doing
and
what
I really, you know, I had no experience with movies at all. I didn't understand any of the politics involved or how you were supposed to act at a rehearsal. All I knew was just be the best actor you can be, you know, like really commit to something and try to make it as real as possible. And, you know, some of the other people on the film were a little more cool, like, I'm going to save it for the filming or whatever. And I was just, you know... I remember at one point when I eventually got the role that I got in the movie, we were doing one of my first scenes, and we did one. We did a couple takes, and then I felt like the last take we did, I didn't do it exactly right, and I felt bad, like, I could do that better. And I said to Brian De Palma, I said, Brian, can we do another one? Because, you know, I think I could do better. And he was like, oh, really? And then he announces to the crew, Mr. Reilly would like another take. And I was just this kid. I didn't realize, like, that was a big deal to ask for another take. Like, I just thought, like, well, don't we all want it to be better? And
did he give you the other take?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, that was I actually accomplished one of the goals of my life on that movie, which was, I had heard the story when I was a younger actor about the Marx Brothers. When they were filming, they would get to improvising and goofing around so much that the cameraman would start to laugh, and the camera would start. In those days, I guess they had the cameras on a gimbal that they couldn't lock off. It would just be this kind of free floating thing, and they said that you'd see the film, the frame would start to shake and shake and shake and shake, and eventually the lens would just fall down and point to the ground as the cameraman literally fell down from laughter. They couldn't operate the cameras anymore. They were laughing so hard. I was like, wow, I want to do that someday. I want to make the director laugh so much that it actually ruins the tape.
Brings
and
the
it happened. On Casualties of War, it happened. Brian De Palma was on a crane. You know, they have a chair on the crane. You sit up, you know, when the camera needs to go really high, you sit up there with the camera. And I was doing something. I was also a pretty dim-witted character in that movie. And I just did something that was just so ridiculous that Brian started laughing. And because he was laughing, it was shaking the whole crane. And they actually missed the shot. So,
You have been working ever since and we're got a lot of great reviews for three Paul Thomas Anderson films you did, you know, Heart 8, Magnolia, and Boogie Nights. And I thought maybe we'd listen to a clip from Boogie Nights.
All right.
This is one where, I mean, this is a movie about the porn industry in the 70s and 80s. You're a porn star along with Mark Wahlberg. And this is sort of, as we're getting into the 80s and you guys are into cocaine and you've convinced your great recording stars and have made a demo tape, which is excruciatingly bad. And in this scene, you have gone to the studio to pick up the tape, but you don't have any money, and you are trying to convince the guy at the studio to give you the tape. So let's listen. This is Boogie Nights and my guest, John C. Reilly.
Come on, all right? All we need is tapes for
No, you don't get them until you pay.
In our situation, that doesn't make any sense.
Wait, we can't pay the price of the demo tapes unless we take the demo tapes to the record company and get paid.
Hello, exactly.
That's not an MP. That's a YP. Your problem. Come up with the money, and I'll give you the tapes. That's it.
Okay. All right, now you're talking above my head, all right? I don't know this industry jargon, YP, MP, whatever, okay? All I know is that I cannot get a record contract. We cannot get a record contract unless I take these tapes. And granted, the tapes themselves are your you own them, okay? But the magic that is on the tapes, that heart and soul that we put into those tapes, that is ours, and you don't own that. Now I need to take that magic and get it to the record company, okay? And they're waiting for us. We're supposed to be there half hour ago.
Yeah, that's my guest, John C. Reilly from the film Boogie Nights. You know, but that I think that film really holds up well over time.
It's funny you were talking about the improvisation. That whole run in that movie was improvised. That the whole section in the recording studio was improvised, and that was, you know, that's where I sort of got my sea legs for riffing was there with Paul, because he would just let us go crazy. He would let us do anything. And it's funny, between Boogie Nights and Days of Thunder, you know, those are kind of like begat Talladega Nights. If you think about the story arc of Boogie Nights and the title itself, and then a lot of the stuff that, you know, the hero arc of Days of Thunder, those are the two movies that kind of, they must have been thinking about when they wrote the script for Talladega Nights.
Right, Days of Thunder was the stock car racing film starring Tom Cruise that you
right.
were in, right?
Yeah, that I did 15, 16 years ago.
Yeah. You know, the thing about your character in Boogie Nights is that I can't ever quite tell whether he's just dim-witted or so cocaine-addled that he can't get his thoughts straight.
Is there a difference? drug-induced dim-wittedness.
Right, yeah. Right.
I think Reed's pretty smart, actually. He's just kind of a dork, but I love that character. I love playing him so much.
You went on and worked with Martin Scorsese on Gangs of New York. Tell us about that. What was that like, working with him?
I was pretty nervous the whole time around him on that movie, and the way I dealt with it was by being extremely polite. You know, I have a lot of respect for him, obviously. I think he's the greatest living film director out there. And working with him, you realize what the priorities on a film set should be. And you realize it's not about, you know, just facilitating how quickly we can shoot something I don't know. There's like a sanctity to a Martin Scorsese set. When he walks into a soundstage of, you know, 100 Italian people who love to talk, and suddenly the whole place goes dead quiet. You know, like, wow, this is really special. Everyone here is here because they really want to be here. They really want to make a great film. Sadly, that's not the case most of the time. Most of the time on movie sets, everyone's got some different agenda in terms of why they're there. So most people are there because it's a job and they just want to make some money, and the content of what they're doing is not that important. But when you work on a Scorsese film, you think like, wow, this is the best place in the world of movies right now to be. I'm standing right here in the inner circle of it. And so that was never lost on me, on The Aviator either, for that matter.
Actor John C. Reilly. He'll be back in the second half of the show. Here he is with Mark Wahlberg from the soundtrack of the film Boogie Nights. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
All day, all night, you feel my heat. Feel my heat.
I think we should repeat that again.
Feel my heat.
Feel my heat. Yeah, it's definitely cool.
I think we're ready to lay it down.
Let's lay it down. Nick?
You want to lay it down?
Are we rolling on the rehearsal?
Still rolling. Do it one more time. Ready?
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. From the Cato Charitable Foundation, advancing environmental values and saluting all those who work to sustain our world. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, playing Stanley in a Broadway revival of A Streetcar Named Desire and singing and dancing in the movie version of Chicago. More of our conversation with John C. Reilly. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new animated feature film, Happy Feet. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest is actor John C. Reilly. He's appeared in more than 40 films, including the NASCAR comedy with Will Ferrell, Talladega Nights. It comes out this month on DVD. Yeah, well, 2002 was a very big year for you. That was the year where you had significant roles in three of the five movies nominated for Best Picture, Gangs of New York, The Hours, and Chicago, for which you earned your own Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor. You played Amos Hart, who was the two-timed husband of Roxy Hart, played by Renee Zellweger in the film. And I thought maybe we'd listen to your performance of one of the signature songs in that film. So why don't we give a listen to this? This is my guest, John C. Reilly. And I guess for the audience, so some may not have seen it, that basically you're a husband who is very put upon And there comes a point in the film in which you sort of describe your lot to the audience. Let's listen.
If someone stood up in a crowd and raised his voice up way out loud and waved his arm and shook his leg, you'd notice him. If someone in the movie show yelled, "Fire in the second row, this whole place is a powder keg," you'd notice him. And even without clucking like a hen, everyone gets noticed now and then. Unless, of course, that personage should be invisible, inconsequential. Me. Cellophane, Mr. Cellophane, should have been my name, Mr. Cellophane, 'cause you can look right through me, walk right by me, and never know.
That's my guest, John C. Reilly, performing the song Cellophane in the musical Chicago. You know, I know singing is nothing new to you. You've been doing it for a long, long time in musicals on stage. But you're probably known as a dramatic actor a lot more to movie audiences. How did you get that role in Chicago?
Well, I was asked by Rob Marshall to do it, but there was this little hiccup in the process where Rob wanted to have people in the movie who could sing and dance. That was very important to him, that everyone be able to do their own singing and dancing. So no one was getting a part unless they came in and met with him and sang for him and danced a little bit. And he was in New York and couldn't come to Los Angeles. I was in Los Angeles and couldn't go to New York. So I made a videotape of myself with a little bow tie on, singing Mr. Cellophane in front of a big white piano with a candelabra behind me, and sent that along, and you know, I think that's maybe why I got the part, because Rob could see from that tape, like, okay, he understands, you know, what's at the heart of this song, you know, what it's about, and I think Rob was hoping to bring to that character a realism, rather than kind of an over the top clownish sort of sad sack who you don't really believe would be married to Roxy. He wanted it to be like a real working class guy from Chicago who works in a garage, who loves this girl, and it was important to him to sell the realism part of the movie. So that's one of the cool things about Chicago, is like you go into these fantastic fantasy sequences, but when you're in the real world part of that movie, it feels very real. It feels like this cruel time in the 1920s in Chicago, you know. And all the scenic design, the costumes and everything just seems like a realistic picture of that time.
You know, it's interesting because you're right. I mean, and a lot of the dialogue, I mean, it sounds like a guy who's being interviewed by cops after a murder and at moments like that. And yet in the performance that we just heard, there's enormous physical stuff happening. You're doing a kind of a shuffle that evokes, I'm not sure what, Stan Laurel?
Yeah, there was a whole bunch of people. First of all, that song was written by John Kander and Fred Ebb as kind of an homage to Burt Williams, who was a famous vaudeville star who had a song called Nobody. He was actually the biggest, he was a black man, and he was the biggest vaudeville star of the day. He was the star of the Ziegfeld Follies and had a famous song called Nobody, and it's all about, you know, some of the same sentiments that are in Mr. Cellophane. And so, yeah, there was that, and there's, you know, everyone from Emmett Kelly to Burt Lahr to Stan Laurel to Dick Van Dyke to, I mean, all the tramp clowns over the years right. That have influenced me. It was like, I felt like it was just a really, really special moment. Like someone was handing me a torch, and I was getting to hold that torch for a second before handing it on.
We're speaking with John C. Reilly. He co-stars with Will Ferrell in the film Talladega Nights, which comes out soon on DVD. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is actor John C. Reilly. His NASCAR comedy with Will Ferrell, Talladega Nights, comes out this month on DVD. You know, another film of yours that I wanted to talk a little about is Criminal, the film by directed by Gregory Jacobs, filmed a couple of years ago. Was this your first leading role? People talk about you being a character actor and having so many great supporting roles. Was this the first time you really carried a film?
I guess so. You know, I'm always surprised. I'm always kind of ambushed by that question when people say, you know, this is your first or whatever. Because the truth is, I think of every role I play as the leading role in that person's life story. You know,
right.
Even if you're playing a supporting part, it's not like you're thinking, well, I'm just a supporting human being. You know, you're thinking of yourself in the way that everyone thinks of themselves as the central character of their life story. But yeah, Criminal was the first time, I guess. They sold the movie on my face, for better or worse. But I loved doing that movie. It was shot very quickly in Los Angeles. We had about 28 shooting days, and we shot in all real locations all over the city. And I felt like that movie, I'm happy you brought it up, because I'm really proud of that movie. And as someone who's lived in Los Angeles for about the past 10 years, I was getting really tired of seeing movies that didn't portray L.A. the way I saw it, in all of it, you know, in all the different facets of L.A. And that's, even though the movie is a very tight kind of daytime noir caper movie, it's also this amazing look at Los Angeles, and not just palm trees and people on rollerblades eating frozen yogurt, you know, which is what you see most of the time when they show a scene in Los Angeles in a movie, but the East Side, and you know, all the different neighborhoods and stuff. And I thought it was an honest look at what life on the streets in L.A. is like, a little bit, anyway.
Well, you know, we have a clip I wanted to play for the audience here, and I'll just set this up. This is, the film, you play a con man, and you develop a friendship with, as you mentioned, Diego Luna, who's a great actor who was in Y Tu Mama Tambien. And you're showing him the ropes, recruiting him as your apprentice. And in this scene, we catch you in the middle of pulling a con on a waiter, where you pretend to have paid him $100 and demanding the change. And then this is followed by a little dialogue in which you talk with Diego Luna about the experience. Let's listen.
Okay, you didn't pay, so don't shout.
I don't want to shout, but I'm late. Now, I want to see the manager. Go get your boss. Don't be stupid.
Excuse me, is there a problem here?
Yes, this gentleman says that he paid.
No, I did pay you.
There seems to be some sort of confusion.
No, there's no confusion. I had a cup of coffee, I had $200 bills, and now I have one. Oh, here. The corner's missing. So the bill I paid with must be missing the corner. Can you check the register and see if there's a $100 bill with the corner missing, please?
Yes, could you come with me, please?
I'm not going anywhere. Get my change, please. I have to get out of here.
I knew that trick.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Did you ever try it?
No.
Why not?
It's too loud.
What?
You know, you have to make a whole scene.
That's the point. They're not interested in making a scene. That's the key, okay? The more offended you are, the less suspicious you look. You know, if things get sticky, you blame everybody else. Have you been paying attention?
That's my guest John C. Reilly with Diego Luna in the film Criminal. You want to talk a little about getting that part, being the con man? I mean, inhabiting the part, getting that character right.
Yeah, going into it, I thought, oh, this is great, you know, because it's really a lot like an actor's life, being a con man, you know, getting people to believe something that's not true, you know, getting them to believe that you're someone that you're not, and I thought, well, that'll be fun, I have a lot in common with this guy. And then I realized when I started playing the part, like, this guy lives on the dark side of the, you know, if acting ability is the force, he's using the force for dark purposes.
Right.
And I realized, like, how lonely that is. And when you do bad things to people, how paranoid you become. You know, I suddenly realized, like, wow, this guy is truly an island. He's sacrificed everything for money. You know, he's like an addict, but his addiction is money, and he'll do anything to get it, and he sacrifices every relationship in his life. And by the end of that month, I was really glad to take that gray suit off that I spent the whole movie in, because it felt like, I don't know, that guy was just such a dark, dark soul.
Huh, interesting.
And kind of hapless as well. You know, he ends up being kind of the, he ends up being the dupe at the end of the movie, so this kind of pathetic character in the end. But, yeah, it was cool. That was a fun movie to do.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some people have described
it. It's fun to get to, you mean, because I think about, as an actor, you know, I'll go into a place and I'll think, well, you know, if I told this person, you know, if I told this woman at this rental car counter that the car was, you know, this, I got carjacked, or I could make up some story, and I could probably make it realistic enough this person would really believe it, and I could get them to do something. And then, you know, you realize, like, oh, no, but I could never do that. That would be like using a force of good for evil. But it was really funny be given the license to do it in Criminal. You know, I got to actually act out all these little fantasy ruses that you hear about con men pulling.
Despite your, I think, your growing success and recognition on screen, you've continued to do interesting things off the screen. I mean, and I will tell you, my son, who was in school in Boston, was an usher at a performance that you did of a musical version of the film Marty, right? Where
right.
You headlined that, and then you did Streetcar Named Desire on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
You want to keep your hand in stage
work. I've actually
work.
Done Streetcar twice. I did it in Chicago at the Steppenwolf Theater, where I played the part of Mitch,
right?
Stanley Kowalski's best friend, and then last year on Broadway, I got to play Stanley, which was really interesting to do the same play twice, but in different roles.
How did you find the experience of doing Stanley?
It was a bear. You know, I suddenly realized I used to, one of the big, you know, mysteries to me before I did Streetcar was regarding Marlon Brando was, you know, Brando did Streetcar and then never did another play his entire life. I mean, to me, that would be like, you know, John Lennon playing one concert and saying, you know what, I'm not going to play any more concerts. And, you know, because, you know, I mean, Brando had such promise. Of course, he went on to make some great films, but as a theater actor, you know, everyone, he was the gold standard, and then he never did it again. And I remember meeting some people in Hollywood who knew him and asking people actively before I had done Streetcar, why do you think Brando never did another play? What is that? And people give me different answers. Oh, well, you know, you come out to California and people like the weather, and they, you know, movies are very, you know, alluring and the money's good. And I thought, none of that could be true. Not with an artist like Brando, you know. There must be some other reason. I was always dissatisfied with the answers people gave me. And then about 2 months into the run of Streetcar on Broadway, when I was playing Stanley, I was sitting backstage between acts, and it dawned on me, of course he never did another play. Because I only did Streetcar for 6 months as Stanley. Brando did it for 2 years. And the emotional and psychological toll that play takes on you every night is just, it's almost like Tennessee Williams just was like, had the sadistic streak, because what he puts those characters through is incredibly difficult, you know. And it's not just the Blanche DuBois character that's broken. Stanley will never be the same man after the events that take place in that play. And Stella will never be the same woman. She'll never look at Stanley the same way. And, of course, Blanche goes off to the nut house, and Mitch loses the love of his life, and there's just these shattered people at the end of that play. And if you're playing that material honestly and you're really giving it your all, that stuff has a big effect on you. And you can try to let it go when you get out of the theater, but knowing that you're going back into that every night, this sort of crucible of emotional pain, it's finally made sense why Brando, you know, never did another play.
Now, you haven't forsworn the theater, have you?
No, of course not. Like I said, I only had to do it for 6 months, and I got a lot out of that production, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. But I'll tell you, there were some pretty big expectations surrounding that play itself and the role of Stanley that I knew there would be, you know, slings and arrows to suffer in that regard, taking on this big role, but I had no idea how many preconceptions people were going to come with. And the truth is, a lot of people who came to see that play, their preconceptions were based on the film, which is very different than the play. You know, they rewrote a lot of the play to suit the morals of the time at the in the film business. So the play is different than the movie. And I thought one of the big misconceptions I thought people had about Stanley was that he's supposed to be this hunk. You know, he's this attractive, charismatic, like, you know, sex bomb kind of character. And that, to me, is a complete misreading of the play. And if you read what Tennessee Williams said about that character, and you read what Brando said about that character in his autobiography, Brando said, I thought I was miscast in that part because the audience, if I felt like I threw the balance of the play off because Stanley is, in a lot of ways, the villain of the play, you know? And he's written as a Polack, a simple-minded Polack guy who's, you know, he's striving to make a better life for himself, but he's not this attractive, you know,
right,
steamy leading man type. He's like an animal, you know? It's like, it's almost like his relationship with Stella is almost like bestiality, you know? Like,
well, this is interesting.
She, this Southern Belle, is attracted to this animal, you know? So that's the take I took on the character. It was a very literal take on what Tennessee Williams wrote. He's a working class guy who came back from the war, who fought for his country, and his whole life growing up, people were told him he was a Polack and he was no good and he was poor and he was simple. Then he went away to the war and risked his life for the country. When he came back, he said, you know what? No one will ever tell me I'm not as good as them. No one will ever tell me that this country is not mine because I risked my life for it. So he has this chip on his shoulder that was just, you know, it fills you with rage, but there's this, I don't know, it's an amazing character.
Well, John C. Reilly, we'll look forward to seeing what you come up with next. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Actor John C. Reilly. He stars as a NASCAR driver with Will Ferrell in the film Talladega Nights. The DVD is being released this month. Earlier this week, Terry Gross recorded an interview with Chris Gaffney and David Gonzalez of the Hacienda Brothers. We'll feature that interview soon on Fresh Air. The Hacienda Brothers play music which is a mixture of country, soul, honky-tonk, and rock. Their new CD, What's Wrong with Right, features a number of soul tune covers. Here's Chris Gaffney singing, with Dave Gonzalez on guitar, doing a song written by the Philadelphia International Songwriting Team, Gamble and Huff. The Hacienda Brothers. We'll feature an interview with them soon on Fresh Air. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new 3D animated musical Happy Feet. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. As the film Happy Feet's domestic earnings approach $100 million, the animated musical has started to pop up on lists of prospective Best Picture nominees. It's directed by George Miller, best known for films like Mad Max and The Witches of Eastwick, and it features the voices of Nicole Kidman, Hugh Jackman, Elijah Wood, and in several parts, Robin Williams. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The animated Penguin picture Happy Feet has been the country's number one draw for the past 2 weeks, and if you haven't taken the plunge, you should. Not just because it's stupendous, but because it features the best dancing you'll see on the screen this year. Not that these penguins are supposed to dance. The penguins here, one tribe anyway, are singers. To mate successfully, they need to find their inner music, what they call their heart songs. And if you've seen the documentary March of the Penguins, you'll be amazed at how these animators get something of the look of a real penguin courtship ritual, even if the actual birds don't serenade their prospective mates with Elvis Presley or Beach Boys songs. Our hero, though, is a penguin who's made of more manic stuff. To the shock of his dad, Memphis, voiced by Hugh Jackman, he comes tap-tap-tapping out of his egg.
Wait, you hear that?
Yeah.
Hey, I can hear you, buddy.
Oh, he's okay, Maurice. That's his little foot there. There's his other one. You okay?
Freezy.
Oh, you get used to it. Come on, son. Come to your daddy.
Hey, what do you make of that?
A little wobbly in the knees, huh?
Is he okay?
I don't know.
What you doing there, boy?
I'm happy, Pa.
What you doing with your feet?
They're happy, too.
I wouldn't do that around folks, son.
Why not?
Well, it just ain't Penguin, okay?
Okay.
Memphis loves his son, called Mumble, but takes his cues from the penguin elders when the child turns out to have a singing voice that brings down icicles. He's horrified. He's stricken. He doesn't care that Mumble is one amazing hoofer. Before I go on, let me be frank. I think this is a dumb premise. I thought it was a dumb premise in Footloose when they wouldn't let Kevin Bacon dance, but there at least the fundamentalist prohibition had some precedent. The penguins here say that they can only survive in such harsh conditions if they're in harmony. But the rule still seems arbitrary. If you've seen Mary Poppins, you know that penguins are dancing fools. It doesn't matter, though. Once Mumble does his thing, the quibbles fly away. The great Savion Glover modeled the penguins' tap dancing for the animators, and all I could think as I watched was that somewhere Ray Bolger was smiling. It's not big, swinging, ecstatic, Gene Kelly, Donald O'Connor tapping. Mumble uses tap to work out his frustrations, so sometimes the tapping is angry and staccato, and sometimes it's a tap and a little soft shoe slide along the ice. That ice sounds amazing when he taps and slides and taps and slides. Happy Feet could kickstart a vogue for soft shoe ice skating. Movie musicals tend to be chopped up in the editing room so that you see one piece of a body at a time. But the dancing in Happy Feet is often shot straight on against a vast horizon of ice. The penguins have round little tummies, and it's lyrical just the way their weight shifts from side to side. Because the other penguins don't dance, you don't get big ensemble tap numbers, but the film has one medley of pop songs after another, and they flow together the way they didn't in the frenetic hash of Moulin Rouge. Happy Feet has been in the news lately because prominent conservative commentators have attacked its underlying message of conservation. Thanks to overfishing, the birds and animals in the movie are going hungry, and it falls to Mumble to deliver a message to the world to respect the penguin's ecosystem. The tone of the movie is hardly pious, though. Happy Feet was directed by George Miller, the Aussie who gave us The Road Warrior, and Mad Max never faced anything as harrowing as the huge leopard seal that comes after Little Mumble. The big chase is wildly kinetic and vertigo-inducing and practically three-dimensional in the way the leopard seal explodes out of the screen. Later, when Mumble and some penguins from another tribe with movie Mexican accents go on a voyage of discovery, they go whooshing and bouncing and spinning down a mountainside, and one of the penguins yells, I love gravity. I thought, I want to do that too.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, in stores and online at bn.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.org. And from Patricia Papper for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
During the Dust Bowl years of the 1930s, mountains of dust rolled across the Great Plains, blacking out the landscape. People and animals literally choked to death in squalls of flying dirt. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Timothy Egan about the untold story of those who survived. His book, The Worst Hard Time, has won this year's National Book Award. Join us for the next Fresh Air.